content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anika Gal from the NC Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the AARP magazine and a couple of other interesting items from the New York Times as well as AARP.org. So we're going to get started right off the bat with "We're aging fast and not doing anything about it." One of the paradoxes of this presidential campaign is that while many of the candidates are in their eighth decade of life, fundamental issues associated with the aging of American society are still receiving relatively little attention from the public, the press, and politicians themselves. In 2031, the oldest baby boomers will turn 85, entering the land of the, quote, old, and facing exponentially higher risk for dementia, serious physical disabilities, and long-term dependency. Like climate change, the aging of America demands serious reconsideration of the way we live. Confronting the issues and its many implications, from Medicare's failure to cover long-term care to the ethics of physician-assisted dying, requires what seems to be the most difficult task for human beings: thinking about their future. In November, the National Center for Health Statistics reported that the birth rate among women of childbearing age had dropped to a record low, continuing a sharp decline in the births that began around the financial crisis of 2008. At the same time, the Journal of the American Medical Association reported an increased death rate in the 25 to 64-year-old age group, with the main causes thought to be opioid overdoses, alcoholism, and suicide. What these statistics mean is that if these trends continue, always an important caveat in demographic studies, there will be many fewer young and middle-aged people to care for the frailest of the old, whose death rate has not increased in recent years. The population of the prime caregiving age group, from 45 to 64, is expected to increase by only 1% before 2030, while the population over 80 will increase by 79%. In certain respects, the crisis is already upon us. A study published this year by Gallup and West Health, a research organization dedicated to lowering health care costs, showed that people over 65 had withdrawn an estimated $22 billion from long-term savings accounts in the previous year to pay for health expenses Medicare didn't cover. A recently published article in the Journal of the American Geriatric Study underscores the sobering likelihood that one out of seven 65-year-olds today can expect to be disabled for at least 5 years before death. The largest increase in this disabled population is projected to occur in the 2030s. Although there has been considerable talk about health care during the Democratic presidential debates, nearly all of the focus has been on the young with inadequate insurance coverage. That Medicare, as we now know it, fails to work for many retirees, leaving them in danger of going bankrupt, gets short shrift. The other side of the coin is that many people in their 60s and 70s are self-sufficient and hate nothing more than the thought of retirement. Why else would five septuagenarians, Joe Biden, Michael Bloomberg, Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump, and Elizabeth Warren, be seeking the presidency? Because we are aging as a society, it's time to cast aside outdated assumptions that people over a certain age are monolithic, says Jean Acquias, Senior Vice President of Thought Leadership at AARP. We need to recognize the opportunities of all stages of life, not just the challenges. Our conflicting attitudes toward aging play a critical role in the silence about age-related issues. On the one hand, many Americans cherish the idea that 70 is the new 50, a rosy falsehood contradicted by any serious study of the age curve for major diseases. On the other, we remain scared to death of the very word old, which politicians themselves and the journalists who question them almost never use. Older, as in older Americans, tend to be the preferred euphemism. This is particularly silly, given that everyone is older than someone. The day-to-day specifics of what it means to have so many ill old people living longer are so numerous that it is hard to think about them simultaneously. Alzheimer's disease, the most common form of dementia for those over 85, offers a textbook example of this complexity. For people older than 85, the risk of developing Alzheimer's is 14 times higher than for those ages 65 to 69. Contrary to the narrative that America is a selfish society in which most people neglect their older relatives or neighbors, the Alzheimer's Association reports that 83% of help received by old adults in the United States is provided by family members, friends, or other unpaid caregivers. Approximately 2/3 of the caregivers are women, and 1/3 of those aiding people with dementia are daughters. The financial impact on both the old and those in late middle age is staggering. The median savings of people in their middle age is just $15,000, according to the National Institute on Retirement Security. Social Security plus $15,000 presents a scary prospect for those who hope for a decent standard of living throughout the average 20-year American retirement. When dementia strikes, all bets are off, because even if there is a child who desperately wants to keep his or her sick parents at home, it becomes increasingly difficult, if not impossible, to do so without home health care aides, which again, Medicare generally does not pay for. The problem is not just the shortcomings of Medicare, or the inadequate savings of many Americans, or the absence of effective treatment for Alzheimer's. It's all of those things. First, it is vital to address the disturbing human realities behind the statistics. An aging society affects everyone, but it affects women most because of their greater longevity. How can we continue to count on women to provide 2/3 of unpaid caregiving? I gnash my teeth every time I encounter one of those ubiquitous television ads for a business called A Place for Mom, which provides much-needed service by helping people find long-term care for parents. It's not called A Place for Dad for a very good reason. We assume that mom or daughter is caring for dad at home. Second, public programs and private companies need to cooperate to provide opportunities for old people who want to and are perfectly able to go on working. That's an important objective of AARP, which held town halls on aging in Iowa last summer. Most candidates attend at least one of the meetings, but the discussions received little national publicity. Third, a healthier attitude toward aging also means examining moral issues. Physician-assisted suicide, for example, is the source of a fierce ethical debate that matters greatly to anyone who can imagine growing old. Questions about the end of life, like those about abortion, should be posed in every national forum. According to a Gallup poll conducted last year, 72% of Americans agree that doctors should be allowed to help end a patient's life painlessly if there is no hope of a cure and the medical assistance is requested by patients and their families. The support drops to 65% if the phrase doctor-assisted suicide is used instead of end of patient's life. Yet another case of the American preference for euphemism. No single program can deal with the intimate, painful problems associated with the growing proportion of old people who experience long, but not necessarily healthy, lives. Facing our own fears about what it means to grow old without resort to soothing euphemisms is the essential psychological shift that all Americans must make before we can meet the deadline to create a better reality for the old and their families. And this is by Susan Jacoby. She is the author of Never Say Die, The Myth and Marketing of the New Old Age. And this was from the December 26, 2019 issue of the New York Times. Okay, our next one is from the AARP magazine, and it is of this issue. What is it? January 2020. It's entitled, How I Measured Up. High-tech health monitors are all the rage, but could they help a non-athlete like me eat better, get stronger, and live longer? Turns out developing positive habits is all a numbers game. All right, so if we're going to all get old, we might as well try to be as healthy as we can. So that's the impetus behind my reading this article. I have a confession. I've been a professional health writer for 3 decades. But if you were to give me a report card on how well I care for myself, I'd fail almost every basic test of healthy living. And it's not like I don't already know what I need to do. Eat smaller portions. Do fries come with that shake? Move for at least 30 minutes a day. Does fidgeting in my chair count? Do weight-bearing exercises for stronger bones and muscles. Sure, a few hundred coffee mug lifts per day. Consistently get enough quality sleep. Oh, sorry, were you talking to me? Don't smoke. Yay, I've never smoked. Which means I have the same experience that many people have. At my routine doctor visits, I have to listen to the talk that a person of my age, I'm 62, needs to be more proactive with her health to live a long, productive life. I always walk away with good intent, but this year in particular has been rough for the health of my friends and family who are also in their 50s and 60s. I have lost people I love to preventable diseases. This was my wake-up call. And I know that nobody can fix me but me. Or is that entirely true? In the past few years, the market has exploded for consumer devices that can measure just about every aspect of our health and wellness. It started about a decade ago with fitness trackers produced by companies such as Fitbit, electronic gadgets you wear on your wrist to track how many steps you've taken per day and how well you sleep at night. Those morphed into smartwatches led by the Apple Watch, which added a host of features beyond health, but also incorporated everything from noise level detectors to electrocardiogram tests into that little box on your wrist. Now there are all sorts of wearables that can monitor your health from headbands that measure your brain activity, to toe, smart insoles that measure your gait. Some 142 million smart wearables were projected to be sold worldwide in 2019, according to research from CCS Insight. What started with tricked-out pedometers has blossomed into a category of products that let us gather just about as much data as we'd like about our health. Big tech companies, small tech companies, everyone seems to be getting into the market, says Thomas Rieck, a wellness and exercise specialist for the Mayo Clinic Healthy Living Program in Rochester, Minnesota. With the right device, you can easily measure your heart rate, blood pressure, and more. Maybe if I loaded up with all this new technology, I could get a handle on my health. So I went on a 30-day quest to see if digital health devices could help me jumpstart real and sustainable change. The data was all there, inside my body. If I could access it in real time, perhaps I could become more proactive rather than simply reacting when aches, symptoms, or the sight of a changing profile in the mirror moved me to action. Step one, go shopping. In short order, I had on hand a smart weight scale, two blood pressure monitors, a brainwave headband, a posture alert device, and three health-related smartphone apps that work with the Apple Watch I already owned. Next, I sat down with my physician, Darren Morse, in Lansing, Michigan, to create a plan and a baseline for this new effort. We went over my starting numbers, weight, blood pressure, heart rate, and cholesterol and blood glucose levels. And we crafted realistic goals for the next 30 days. Excited by this experiment, I wanted my doctor to be my partner. I wanted him to see my results as the data was coming in. And I wanted to be able to electronically link up with his office. In theory, this is great, he said, but our system isn't set up to receive this kind of information from our patients' digital devices. I was surprised and disappointed. Several years ago, when another doctor in the same large healthcare system had me wear a Holter monitor to look into what appeared to be an irregular heartbeat, the device sent information directly to the cardiac team. That monitor was a part of the system, Morse explained. He offered a compromise. If you record your device data in a notebook and bring it in, we can add that to your medical records. What we can get now from these personal devices is amazing in terms of being able to gather info, but we still need to be able to make sense of what we see. And then came the sage advice. He reminded me that just wearing a digital device wouldn't make me healthier. You actually have to do the work if you want to see results. A frustrating comment, yet I knew he was right. I could push buttons all day long, but just playing with my new toys wouldn't improve my health. Still, wearing digital devices might help keep me motivated. Although I'd previously tried to make lifestyle changes, I wasn't consistent or patient. Failing to see results quickly, I wouldn't know if my actions were doing any good. I'd get discouraged, and like so many people, I would fall off the health wagon with a thud. But perhaps not this time. So I began focusing first on my weight. What should have been an easy initial step, simply getting on the scale each day, proved to be difficult and ego-challenging. It took me 3 days to work up the nerve to get on the Withings Body and Body Plus scale for a baseline. This smart scale not only measured my weight, but also gave me details on my body composition. For example, what percentage of my body is fat? It communicated with my computer, watch, and phone to record my weigh-ins. I gathered my courage, and soon I was logging new numbers each morning. Next up was tracking my food intake via a new phone app called lose it. The plan was to record what I ate and drank and at what time, so I could then tally my day's calorie and nutrient consumption. I drank smoothies with no sugar added in the mornings. I weighed my food when I cooked, and I cut off eating at 7 each evening. What I'd hoped for happened. The act of inputting data helped me stick to my routine, and monitoring my progress kept me motivated. It felt so scientific to be able to see my progress on a screen in real time. I was no longer just going by instinct. The payoff, to my delight, was a 10-pound weight loss by the end of 30 days. Plus, I had more energy and my genes were looser. Along the way, I turned my attention to fitness. My big challenge was this. I work in a home office. My morning commute is 15 steps. So getting a few thousand steps in per day, that would take some effort. To log some decent numbers, I got up every morning and wore my Apple Watch to count steps while I walked around the neighborhood. I ran some errands, too. When I'd check my step count toward the end of the day, I'd see not nearly enough steps. I'd go back outside with a mission of getting 2,000 to 3,000 more. After 30 days, I was at 6,000 daily steps. Many activity trackers use gamification to motivate users. It's a psychological technique with the device granting virtual badges or other rewards at various milestones. It seems from the research that if we can have you do a challenge where you're trying to gain so many points or steps throughout the day, it helps with overall use, Rieck says. I also measured my other physical activities, yoga, Pilates, and lightweight lifting. Plus, like a helpful friend, the watch would give me gentle reminders to get up and move around when it sensed I was glued to my chair for too long. Additional gamification. There was more gear to put to use, and so I did. I measured my blood pressure 3 times each day using a Moka cuff device. It was exciting to watch the numbers go down over the month, eventually by more than 10 points for both my systolic and diastolic averages. Must have been the extra exercise and some diet changes. Saying goodbye to potato chips and see ya to ice cream was hard. Tracking my progress on charts and graphs, however, made this a bit easier. 2 meditation apps, Headspace and Calm, and a wearable device called Muse, M-U-S-E, the numeral 2, helped me break the vicious cycle of drinking coffee to stay awake, but then losing sleep because of all the caffeine and anxiety, which just caused me to drink more coffee the next day. The apps gave me guided meditation lessons through my smartphone. And then Muse 2 used electroencephalogram sensors that measured my brain wave activity. I worked up to 15 minutes of meditation twice a day, and the data showed I was successful at quieting my mind. That led to better sleep. Wearing a posture device, Upright Go, made me more aware of when my back was not in good alignment through an annoying but necessary means, buzzing every time it detected I was slouching. I would wear it for about 15 minutes per day, but that was enough negative reinforcement to improve my posture, even without the buzzing reminders. The result was fewer aches and pains. After 30 days of mad science, I checked in with my doctor, but I already knew the news. My little experiment had worked. I had been able to stay focused on my health in a way I could never accomplish before, so all my vital signs had improved. I am proud of you, Moore said. You are moving all the results in the right direction, And now you have to keep up the good work. The doctor was right. The challenge would hardly end there. We know that, unfortunately, a lot of people who have an activity tracker use it for about 3 months and then abandon it, Ryack offers. People get really excited that it's new and different, but then realize they bought the wrong model, or it doesn't track accurately, or it's just too cumbersome to use, so they stop using it. Forget that. I remain excited about the possibilities. Here's the ultimate data point. Zero. That's the number of nerves I felt going to my physician's office. I don't need a tracker to tell me I haven't felt that way in a long, long time. And Andrea Collier is a multimedia health journalist based in Lansing, Michigan. She is the author of The Black Woman's Guide to Black Men's Health and Still With Me, A Journey of Love and Loss. AARP, the magazine, associate editor Emily Pullen contributed to this report. All right, pretty good, huh? All right, and finally, some best practices. All right, do invest in long battery life. Every time you have to take off that device, that's time you're missing out on data, says Thomas Ryack, a Mayo Clinic wellness and exercise specialist. Look for devices that can go days or even weeks on a single charge, then limit recharging to a period of downtime, perhaps at night, unless tracking sleep patterns is a priority, or while in the shower. Get social. Many fitness trackers allow you to share data with others. Go ahead and show off. Connecting with others, whether with friends or family or even to a community, has been shown to increase people's overall use, Ryack notes. And don't spend big bucks. We're definitely seeing a lot of really great trackers come down quite a bit in price, Ryack says. So don't go straight for the top-of-the-line device. In lots of cases, an older, less expensive model will work just fine. Well, we have come to the end of our program today, today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Anika Gal, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, the NC Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Good luck with all that health stuff. I'm going to be monitoring mine as best as I can with a lower-end device, I think, not quite so expensive. All right, see you next time. Have a great week.